Well, good morning, everybody. Looks like we've got a bit of a small crowd here. So I had a chat with Eric, and in the course of his presentation, he said that you feel free to ask questions during the presentation, especially when we have such a small crowd. So the title of today's presentation is Equity and Transparency in the Financial System. My name is Barry Dillon. I work with PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I'm going to chair the session. The presenter today is Eric Ranson. Eric has been working in the U.S. life settlement market for the past 6 years. He currently manages a U.S. $200 million life settlement fund for Catalyst, a UK-based firm. Eric has broad experience in the finance and securitization industry through a variety of appointments and consulting roles. He was involved in the startup of the Australian mortgage securitization market and later became treasurer of Australian Mortgage Securities, and was responsible for risk management and funding of $20 billion of prime mortgages in Australia and New Zealand. Before this, he helped establish an Australian commercial paper conduit with over $1 billion of assets. Eric left the actuarial world to manage swaps and options books at Bankers Trust. He has his own consultancy firm, but has also consulted for Tillinghast and Myra. So I'll hand you over to Eric now. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. Well, thank you very much for coming along. It's nice to have some people to talk to, at least. Today I wanted to kind of just discuss some pretty broad issues and maybe get down to some specific issues at the end and get as much feedback as I can from everybody here. But, the main things I wanted to discuss was, why do we become actuaries? Can we change the world for better? And probably most importantly, is there any overlap between those two questions? Can actuaries change the world for the better? As Barry said, please just feel free to ask questions anywhere along the way. I actually prefer an interactive thing than a sort of speech and anything formal. So, I sort of read the web page for this financial services forum. It's an opportune time for the actuarial profession to lead the development of a more robust industry and to ensure better outcomes for savers, investors and retirees in the new regime. Sort of sounded like pretty bold stuff. Leading and ensuring and all that sort of stuff, and I kind of wondered what it meant. But I'd given a talk last year about how actuaries could potentially get involved in changing the corporate world for the better, and so this kind of attracted me back to this speaker's podium. Basically because I think I'm sort of a bit more interested in why we want to be actuaries in this sort of world, and I think there's a lot more sense in the actuarial profession that we want to actually change the world rather than for the good, for the better of everybody, rather than just focus totally on ourselves. Unfortunately, along the way, I've become a little bit cynical and probably see the world differently to when I actually did my actuarial studies. Can the world change? Well, I guess my observation is that change doesn't happen just because it should, because that'd be good. It only happens when it creates sufficient opportunities. And I think the reality of the world is that we've just seen increasingly that the opportunities that create change are financial opportunities, and typically involves people taking advantage of the system because they can. So I was watching a movie with my son a week ago and was struck by one of the comments. Spaceballs is a send up a Star Wars, if for those of you who weren't aware, and I wasn't aware a couple of weeks ago, but Mel Brooks was a producer of a lot of movies 20 or 30 years ago, so I probably should have been aware of this one. But the evil character, or the baddie in the movie, says, "Evil will always triumph because good is dumb." And I think for me that kind of describes the way the world is. And it's, I don't think it's saying, and you know, we see what we want to see, and we read into things what we want to read into them. But I think the reality is that you know, good and evil aren't necessarily intelligent and unintelligent. But I think it's about motivation. Evil tends to rely on fear and greed as the prime motivators, and fear and greed tend to work. I guess anyone involved in the financial markets has been taught that. Good, on the other hand, in general, tends to rely on justice and moral superiority, which tend not to be quite as good as motivators as fear and greed. So, tell a teenager that they shouldn't have sex because it's not moral, and you probably won't have much of an impact on their lives. But in the old days, I think they used to go with the line, "If you have sex, you'll go to hell," and that probably worked a little bit better. In fact, the church probably worked generally a lot better when they had the Spanish Inquisition and a few more appropriate tactics up their sleeves. Yeah, thank you.
Another the problem then that it's a behavioural problem, because it comes down to basic human instincts and needs and so on. So how do actuaries, who aren't necessarily the best people dealing with other people, go to change the behaviour of the couple of people that's powerful and over?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and I'm glad you asked it. The first thing we're trying to do... I was trying to establish was where the problem lie, and I think it is a big problem, and I don't think we necessarily have all the answers, but as I said last year, I was trying to suggest some ways to change one system, and today I'm trying to come forward with a few ideas regarding ways to motivate change, which we'll get to very soon. But yeah, the point being that the robust changes we talked about on the financial services website I think require some motivational changes to actually last. Sorry. Apologies to any Star Wars fans. I've thought I'd continue the theme. But we're in line with your comment, Guy, that can actuaries, or concern that, can actuaries actually have an impact? And the reasons that, I thought that actuaries might be able to have it an impact is because the profession's small enough, and it's got some influence, and I think that's important. Bigger professions, I think, end up with the same problems that the society ends up with, and you don't have that professional tradition. So I mean, accountants are just the policemen of the future, and lawyers have just realised that they get more benefit out of continuing to argue about things rather than actually producing things, and doctors have worked out how to milk the public purse and just got to work out how to provide a little bit of service and get more money out of the private sector. And, you know, architects are probably the exact opposite way around. So, you know, actuaries are a little group there. A few years ago, I was wondering, you know, where are we going? Are we going to be just taken over by accounting firms and all that sort of stuff and disappear? But I think there's potentially a role for us to play as the, wise old men and women who can maybe create a little bit of change. And one of the huge positives about the actuarial profession is that we've got a bit of a perspective on an appreciation of the long-term financial consequences of things, which I guess will be some of the prime drivers of things. I mean, we're already seeing medical costs going through the roof, demographic changes, and governments that just like spending because people vote for them if they do that. So, let's pick an area. And once again, I'd just gone back to the Financial Services Forum website, which suggested that we should be making robust changes to, the outcomes for savers, retirees and investors. So let's look at the so I kind of said, oh well, let's start with the investment process, see if we could discuss and come up with some potential changes there that might work. I mean, my understanding of the retail investment business is that somebody throws in $100, $5 goes in commissions to the guy they talk to, and then the investment industry takes out $5 or $10, and if there's any super profits in the returns, then the intermediaries grab them. So, basically, there's probably a lot of variation between providers, but. But it's a pretty simple equation. How can you make it better? Well, potentially you make it more efficient, cut some of those costs, and potentially give the investors a little bit more of the upside. I guess be remiss of me not to mention the. Kind of change that people are talking about as a result of the economic crises, but it seems to me like it's more of this spin and more of the same. Regulation is sort of seems to be the most popular answer to all of our financial problems, and my perspective is that the whole regulation system barely works. It's basically politicians going, okay, well, let's use somebody else's money to set up a regulator so we've got somebody to blame. But the politicians still make the rules, the regulators don't make the rules, so they're sitting there going, well, I can't change the rules, all I'm doing is managing this, so all I want to do is cover my backside. So I think you tend to make it difficult for Honest John to come in and get into the business and provide a good product. And I don't think you actually stop the guy who's got the gift of the gab and an intention to defraud the system.
Your logical conclusion from that is there should be no regulation. You're also, that's, to extremes, you shouldn't have police because there's still going to be someone who's going to commit crime against others and you can't stop it.
Well, I think in regard to regulation, my sense is that there's three key points to a good platform. First point is make it illegal to say the government should do something about this. Second point is make it illegal to say the regulator should do something about this. And the third point is have some genuine punishments for people who actually do defraud and hurt investors. What I see out there, and once again it's good and evil, the natural thing for good people to do is to say, oh yeah, he was a bit naughty, but he's got all these references from all these other guys that says he's not a bad bloke and we'll let him off. Or he's a nice guy with two kids and a family and he sort of went astray and managed to misinvest $200 million and lost half of it and it was just an aberration, or he was under pressure, or let's let him off. All the incentives in the system are I've worked in investment banks, it's like, let's sell product, how can we hide the amount of money we're taking out of it? So I was at Bankers Trust when the Procter & Gamble thing was going on. And, the chairman of Bankers Trust at the time, some southern gentleman in the US, and, at the conferences is, we're all going to be rich. And it didn't really matter how. It was just, let's create a derivative on the back of the interest rate squared. At the time, interest rates had been in a long-term declining trend. So while that continued, everything was fine. You did a $100 million derivative, you took $10 million out up front, but they even sort of did the revals that kind of graded out that upfront stuff. So it was all very well managed to take money away from supposedly the client that you were serving, sort of thing. And of course, like all these other financial crises, it blew up when, interest rates have gone up now. I guess the current crisis is more about credit than movements in interest rate, but they're availability of credit and stuff like that. It's kind of simple stuff that it goes up and it goes down, or markets go up and down, and availability of credit might go up and down. And if you have excessive spending for long periods, things might run out. Does that transfer across to policing as a logical extension? Probably not sure that it does, but maybe you devote a small amount of resources to regulation, relying on the regulator to sort everything out, I think, is not right. I'm not really aware of the regulators coming up with too many cases of actually recovering funds for people when funds have been lost. They tend to sort of do investigations and all sorts of things, and then maybe try and penalise the person who's involved. And it seems like most of the headlines say, well, they didn't actually get there 5 years down the track when the court result came out. But anyway, probably shouldn't get too bogged down on my bigoted views on regulation.
I guess, Eric, one of the things with regulation, it's a pretty obvious point, but when you look at how regulators are staffed, they tend to be, you'll have junior analysts that have opted as a start in their career versus other places, possibly because of the ease of getting employment. You think about the most, and some people that are in a career switch or whatever, and not to be unfair to people working regulators, but if you think, where would the most powerful regulation come from? It would be people at the peak of their profession actually working in the institutions and being regulated.
Yeah.
If they could swap around and regulate, and they had the right ethos, then it'd be a crackerjack job. So from a professional point of view, maybe it's a call for a serious pro bono rotation or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's... But the senior guys would probably want to sort of be able to manage the system a little bit more, and that would mean taking away power from the politicians, and they probably wouldn't want to be labelled or taking all the blame and none of the responsibility and all the rest of it. So it's a tough one.
There's a model in the way reserve banks run now. They're meant to be totally independent of governments.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that sort of system tends to work better if it's independent, and I'd certainly encourage anything we could do on that front. I've mentioned a couple of other issues there. Disclosure, I guess, is as far as I can tell. I mean, the huge problem there is just disclosure. Hits intermediaries, so they, as much as possible, just want to hide the process and hide their remuneration. So disclosure doesn't tend to work for them. I guess actuaries are tending to try and get involved in risk management, and while I think that they probably can add some value in that, it's sort of at the micro level rather than as far as I can tell. Ensuring better outcomes and leading the way and all the rest of it. So all of these things are just trying to affect the supply side of the investment market. It seems to me like there's probably an opportunity to affect the demand side of the process, because, I mean, as an investor, I've always sort of said, well, could somebody just tell me a bit about this company, you know, what's the structure? Who's benefiting from it? What remuneration do they get in a bad situation? In a bad financial outcome, or in a good financial outcome? I think there's a huge role potentially for actuaries to set up a kind of useful information. And I mean, I understand that stockbrokers are trying to provide information to their clients, and probably are improving. You'd have a much better idea on that than me, Greg. But I think if actuaries could drive a much more useful type of platform, that'd be great. But that creates a question. Can actuaries actually sell a platform or make something work? I think there's arguments that they could, because of some of the points that I mentioned there, credibility. You know, I think people like the idea of projections and ranges of potential cash flows and actual information. It's an information sort of generation that expects information. And if we can create a platform that's got transparency and a lot of information in it, you can create sort of some demand, and that demand can drive improvements in transparency and information generally across the board. But yeah, obviously remuneration of the parties involved and those sorts of issues are probably the things that intermediaries or fund management industry is least interested in disclosing, but probably create the most structure was the other thing, yeah.
That sort of information sounds great from our perspective.
Yeah.
Someone sophisticated investor, but the average investors who are getting stung by the people with the behaviours that you're describing, is that really going to help?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very good question, and uh, you know, being an actuary rather than a smooth talker, my answer would be I don't know. But
it reminds me of the time when the PDS disclosure regime was coming in, and the company that I was working for was having their annuity PDS being reviewed, and the comment from a regulator was, investors need more information about the stability of the company, and maybe there should be some summary financial statements in the back of the as if the document wasn't big enough for it.
Yeah.
But think of a simple example that occurs to me. If you think of the, not terribly sophisticated investor, but just a typical older fundamental investor with an asset portfolio and a concept of what the income generation of that portfolio is. Because some private investors do, they decide, well, that's what I'll live off. I'm going to live off the income generation of my portfolio. I'm not going to be that fussed about the pricing volatility of the portfolio. I'm just going to live off the income generator, which is quite stable. It's much more stable than the asset price of the portfolio. But when we go to entice people into annuity products, we put a veil over that and we say, tell us how much money you want, and we'll shred the thing to feed it back to you. And by the by, it ruins the longevity of the whole exercise, but we'll give a spin on that, but there'll be something left afterwards. But a very simple information flow to investors will probably kill some of the product that professional living.
Yeah, and you know, there's conflicts of interest even in the actuarial profession that would need to be discussed. There's definitely a lot of issues. But I mean, one thing that Hazel said at the in her speech that I thought was interesting was she saw a need for a kind of lifestyle product. I'm not coming here with, you know, this is exactly what we've got to do. I've tried to sort of say, well, in the paper, and I read it last night, I don't think it was particularly well expressed, that here's some things we could do. And I like to do that just simply to say, well, that's a point to start discussion. But, I mean, the first thing is to try and create here's a standard way that all investment products should be presented, and the information they should have about conflicts of interest or remuneration and all that sort of stuff, as well as if you could, you know, incorporate projections of expected cash flow and some sort of range, maybe, you know, 10%, 90% upside and downside. I mean, I think that provides a lot of information that man in the street may or may not be interested in, but if it's presented consistently from product to product, could become kind of part of what everybody demands. So, you know, there's the concept of going to a demand sort of driven thing rather than the supply driven thing, you know, which at the moment, I've got a great idea, I'll start up a fund with this and I'll take these big fees out the front and I'll make lots of money, provided I can get $1 billion invested in it, sort of thing. So, but yeah, I mean, if you create a standard, then you know, maybe you publish it on a website, which, you know, may be an Institute of Actuaries thing or maybe somewhere else. Then do you go to the next step and start creating lifestyle product advice or suggesting funds or whatever? And I mean, there's another step. You could actually have an actuarial fund. For some reason, when I was at uni, I thought it'd be a good idea that you actually pool of actuarial knowledge together, and they created their own funds, and potentially actuaries are out there selling a not exciting, just a basic kind of product, and you know, fits in with this sort of lifestyle thing. Maybe it's for the young, for the families, and for the retirees or something. It's not fancy, it costs a low. Obviously, since my time at university, the industry funds have sort of come along and tried to take up a bit of that space. Things are changing slowly. I recognise that, but I guess I was sort of just wanting to throw out a response to the FSF website sort of proposition, which, you know, is that they want to ensure better outcomes for saving investors and retirees in the new regime. I mean, unfortunately, my sense is that, you know, and my cynical sense is that, you know, we come to a conference for 2 days and talk about risk management and doing micro things a little bit better and, yeah, maybe we added a little bit of value somewhere, but basically go away and, yeah, we can all put away the idea of leading the world and ensuring better outcomes for everybody. So, yeah, just a little bit of a dreamer in some ways and a cynic in others. So. Anyway, that was basically what I was wanting to present. So I guess the next step is, just trying to encourage, well, some discussion here and, is it worth going forward? And somebody raised that issue of, are you potentially shooting the profession in the foot because it's getting a lot of income out of the current system? Was that you? Yeah. I mean, do you think that's the case if we set up some sort of actuarially recommended investment sort of presentation and some actuarial funds or recommendations of ways people invest?
I guess if you step back a bit, in a perfect world, if people weren't devoting their time over complicated things which could be done simpler and arguably don't need to be done in the first place with proper education, then maybe while those people wouldn't be employed doing that, they can go and do something else that's very useful. Or maybe as a first step, if the profession was fairly ambivalent between investors going into schemes or products that generated employment, just as happy to help them go into schemes which didn't generate employment. So the employment thing was taken right out of the picture. I mean, that would be their thing.
Well, I mean, in terms of retail savings, I guess these days there's, talk about taking commissions out of it and all that sort of stuff. So there's some potential changes coming, but I mean, it seemed to me that, that'll probably only increase the demand from individual investors, and maybe not all investors, but half investors sort of go, I want to know information, but I don't want to pay somebody $300 an hour to get that information. So can I find a trusted site? So if you've got an Institute of Actuaries, we've got a bit of credibility, trusted site, with lots of information about investing and then a whole lot of information about individual products or potentially a few lifestyle products. I mean, potentially that's quite a potent combination.
Eric, there's one area, which is the so-called ratings agencies. I wonder the extent to which actuaries have a form of fruitful role. I mean, to call Standard & Poor's an agency where it's a company looking after its shareholders, for me, is, as a starting point, that's a little bit opaque. And then you have other organisations such as Morningstar putting their stamp on various investment funds. To what extent are actuaries actively and visibly involved in the rating of investment products around the world?
Well, I think they're actually, getting more and more involved. And I've been to Standard & Poor's in New York and to talk to them about life settlements, which is the area I'm working in at the moment, and had a team of about nine actuaries wander in primarily because they're interested in the subject. And, and I guess in the long term, if it sort of that market grows, they'll probably be involved in more ratings there, which is one reason I was sort of a bit interested in the subject myself. And I think obviously actuarial consultants are doing their own work, which in a way is sort of an alternative to these rating agencies. But I mean, you're right. Rating agencies obviously, and it's been identified these days, have conflicts of interest. Actuaries working for rating agencies are end up being like actuaries working for regulators or actuaries working for accounting firms or whatever. They're doing a job and they've got a boss who says just get this done or pass that or do how can we achieve this or that. So and that's where I worry a little bit about actuaries saying, oh, we'll solve the world's problems by improving risk management techniques. I mean, I think the rating agencies, they can probably add a tiny bit of value, but a lot of other systems, that it just gets corrupted. And as Greg was saying earlier, auditors come in and so you get these young kids coming in straight out of uni being charged out at $300 an hour, seems to be my favourite number for the moment, who don't actually understand securitisation or derivatives or whatever that they're auditing, but that makes sense for the company that's sending them in. And it's the same with the regulators. They just get whoever they can afford to employ or they employ most efficiently. So that there are good people in rating agencies and good people in regulators and good people everywhere, but the way of the world is that it seems to be that they don't always get the final say on things, clearly there's elements of greed and fear that seem to drive. Drive good people away, or advantage people who aren't too worried about some of those issues.
Yeah. Overall, it's certainly an interesting question of how actuaries achieve that sort of goal of influencing the outcomes of the industry change that we're going through. I'm not sure I'm convinced that as a group, the way that we're going to drive that change is by sticking our hands up and saying we're a bunch of actuaries and we're here to help. So there are places where that works through lobbying, through for public policy and things like that, but from a public sense and from a corporate sense, I don't think we're going to win that battle. It's interesting, you made the comment about worrying that actuaries are all going to get swallowed up into accounting firms, and it's one of those actuaries who's get swallowed into an accounting firm. I think there's actually a lot of advantages that come from that, because rather than turning up and saying we're actuaries and we're here to help, you turn up as part of a multidisciplinary team and you say we're here to solve business problems. And then as an actuary being part of that, you get to influence the overall outcome rather than being the voice in the wilderness saying we know what's best for you. It's interesting you started to talk about ratings agencies and art. For all of these channels, actuaries can become influencers in that rather than trying to be the dominant force or the voice trying to provide the answer. I think that's how we're going to agenda some of that change.
So how do you feel about the statement that we're going to lead robust changes that ensure the better outcomes for savers out there? Do you think we're getting a bit caught up in the spin that that tends to go with these sort of conferences?
It's certainly very aspirational. But at the same time, you don't have to lead from the top.
Yeah, I mean, I take your point. There's always that sort of question, am I better off changing from within, where I can have some influence, or am I better off just fighting against the machine sort of thing? And, you know, work for Gorbachev and some of those sort of examples. But I think there's probably a lot of examples where, you know, it doesn't work. You get swallowed up by the machine. So it
definitely works on both sides, because you see situations where the institute is listened to from the public policy, and I think that review is well respected. So both channels still need to be worked as well to generate those sorts of outcomes. And you can see that sort of influence coming through in the Ripple results and outcomes of that review. So there are those, you know, genuine leadership opportunities, but I don't think we should discount the other influencing opportunities that we all have in our own worlds.
Yeah, and so, I mean, some of these changes, you know, maybe in the end you need to say, let's find a vehicle, a profit-orientated vehicle and that just sells it. We've got actuaries working for us who are doing wonderful things and creating wonderful lifestyle products and effectively trying to do some of this stuff, but not doing it as a benevolent kind of professional organisation, but as a profit motivated group on the side. So probably moves a little bit away from the what I read as the purpose of this conference, but maybe if the conference encourages people to go to certain places that have a positive effect, that's the main thing in the end.
That comment about running with the pack, if you think about the role of risk officers in financial institutions, they're often perceived as the people that say, well, these are the boundaries that the institution can work within, and I'm here to monitor when you step out of those boundaries and ring bells and raise alarms and so forth. But if that role was defined instead as, I'm here to help the institution make money efficiently and sustainably, and the emphasis was on helping the institution make money, they would be in the mix. They wouldn't be bypassed, they'd be respected. The influence of that role would be very different.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all already touched on the whole thing about that there's a fair bit of a role to play or to be played by the actual selling. I mean, how you sell yourself or your role is important. And, I guess traditionally life insurers had the actuaries and the sales guys, and the actuaries were kind of traditionally running the things, and then over my lifetime probably it's kind of moved so that the sales guys are running it, and the reality in most organisations is that
the sales guys are always running it.
The guys who can sell are the guys who go up, and they tend to be running it. Maybe our actuarial education's getting better and we've got more sales types involved these days. I don't know. Anyone want to offer a view on that? How are we going for time?
Yeah, I think we've got about maybe 5 minutes left. I guess I had one question in the preliminary session. Hazel mentioned that the complexity of all the reviews that are occurring in Australia may not actually achieve adequacy, and your presentation is about transparency and equity. So do you believe that all the complex reviews might not actually achieve equity, and we'll take our eye off the ball there? And what role do actuaries have in still making sure that investors get equitable outcomes?
Well, it sort of might tie into the sales thing, but my personal opinion is that actuaries, a lot of their kind of expertise is, other people can start claiming, but the thing that we should be promoting as much as possible is our history of sorting out surplus and equitably allocating money. money over time between in pension funds and life insurance funds and all that sort of stuff. So I see allocation of equity as being a kind of core selling point for the actuarial profession. I guess that probably drives the idea that potentially actuaries might be able to create or offer products that work better for individuals and tried to sort of bring that into running corporations more effectively or better, actually having a philosophy, an equitable philosophy that of splitting profits between shareholders and employees sort of thing. So I think there's a kind of a broader role for actuaries potentially in applying allocating sort of tasks to various different systems that maybe hasn't been fully investigated or at the moment, and I get worried that the focus on the real technical stuff means that we end up submerged in rating agencies various other organisations and perhaps not having as big a say as we should have, or we think we should have.
Okay, so I think we're running out of time. Does anybody else have any more questions?
Yeah, just one, Eric. So we've talked a fair bit about, I guess, actuaries as a profession doing this, or actuaries as their role is working for institutions, helping to influence this stuff, and some of the supply side advice in that. Do you have any thoughts on sort of the role that individual actuaries could play? I guess I'm more thinking about demand side, so almost the extent of actuaries hanging out their shingle and saying I'm providing advice as actuaries.
Well, I mean, I think there's always been that right to hang out your shingle once you've got the actuarial qualification, but there's a little bit of a sales side to it too that maybe doesn't suit everybody, even if they've got the ability to provide good advice, doesn't necessarily mean they've got the ability to make a living out of it. Obviously, with the world changing and movement of the, particularly in the areas we've been looking at, it hasn't happened yet, but potentially the movement towards a more sort of user pays for advice type environment. Then there's the do I want to go to Joe Smith and pay him $250 an hour, or who sort of did his one year evening course in financial advice, or do I want to go to an actuary who's charging $300 an hour? Maybe there's going to be a lot more potential there for actuaries to try and sell added value. Still probably because of the specialisation of the profession, probably most of the opportunities are still on the wholesale side, I guess. And that's hard to break into, just as here's my shingle. I'm pretty good at this. Come and hire me. Sounds like we've got a bill.
Okay, thank you very much to everybody for your interaction, and if you put your hands together to thank Eric for his presentation as well.